Today at Reader's Corner, Jay Perini, author of The Passages of H.M., a novel of Herman Melville.
When something has taken place a couple hundred years ago, there's really no way of knowing what really happened unless you had some astonishing documentation which turns up somewhere, which nothing has. In a sense, Hawthorne is responsible for turning Herman Melville into America's greatest novelist with Moby Dick. He certainly drank too much, certainly in the last decades, which I think, you know, was a way of trying to control the manic depression. Melville left virtually nothing behind, a handful of letters. His wife left behind just a very small handful of letters. So I had to kind of invent their relationship, just imagining what they were like. If you read his novels carefully, there's no question that whenever a young man comes into the novel, he gets very interested.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Like the protagonist of his epic novel, Moby Dick, Herman Melville chased what seemed to be a futile dream. Despite the success of his early novels, Moby Dick met with mixed reviews and marked a critical downward slide in Melville's career. It wasn't until well after his death that the brilliance of this ambitious novel, filled as it was with metaphor and symbolism, was recognized. Despite this eventual fame, little is known about Herman Melville. In his novel, The Passages of H.M., Jay Perini delves into the life of this literary icon by detailing his many geographic and literary passages. By fusing fact and fiction, the book brings to life Melville's many travels on the high seas, his failure at home and in his chosen vocation, and his deep friendship with Nathaniel Hawthorne and his lifelong struggle with the nature of God. Dr. Perini is the D.E. Axon Professor of English and Creative Writing at Middlebury College in Vermont and the author of novels, poetry, biography, and criticism. As you probably remember, his novel The Last Station, about Russian author Leo Tolstoy, was made into an Oscar-winning movie directed by Boise State alumnus Michael Hoffman. I interviewed Dr. Perini on this show in 2009 about The Last Station, and I'm pleased to welcome him back today to discuss his latest book. He joins us by phone from his home in Weybridge, Vermont. Jay Perini, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Bob, thank you. I'm really glad to be back on this program. I enjoyed it last time.
Well, I'm just fascinated by the Herman Melville work here because it sounds to me as though there wasn't quite as much material available as you might have had available to you when you did The Last Station. And maybe we should start there. What is the comparison and contrast with writing this book on Melville and that and The Last Station on Tolstoy, the challenge of finding the material, putting this book together?
Well, there's just a world of difference. Every second of Tolstoy's life was recorded. He was keeping a meticulous diary in which he recorded what happened every single day. In fact, he kept not only one diary, but three diaries, three separate diaries at different levels of intimacy, one of which he hid inside of his boot. His wife was keeping a voluminous diary. His doctor was with him every day keeping diaries. Every child, people in the household, his secretary, his publisher, everybody was recording diaries, and also Tolstoy left behind thousands upon thousands of letters. So I had vast documentation for every second of Tolstoy's final year, which I focused on in The Last Station.
You know, we haven't had a chance to talk about this since we only, I think we talked about the book prior to the film coming out, didn't we?
Yeah.
Tell us how you feel about that movie and about what Michael Hoffman did with it and about the Academy Award nominations. You didn't by any chance happen to go to those Oscars, did you?
Yeah, I did. I went to the Oscars, and I was there with Mike. I mean, Mike Hoffman did astonishing service to this novel and to the life of Tolstoy. I mean, he went into it with such meticulous detail. He tried to really understand the character and the conflict between Tolstoy and his wife. And, of course, Mike is a perfectionist, and he went into every aspect of late 19th and early 20th century Russian and world literature. I mean, he made a film which is both beautiful, I think fairly accurate in the sense that all films are somewhat, you know, fictional versions of lives, but tremendously accurate given what it is. And, you know, it's a work of art in its own right, the film, very separately from my novel. It's its own thing.
Well, maybe Michael will do something similar with The Passages of H.M.
Well, we're planning on it. We're hoping to make a movie out of this life of of Herman Melville. It's already something we plan to do. I'm working with his wife, Samantha Silva, on a screenplay right now.
That's wonderful. By the way, speaking of comparing or contrasting Tolstoy to Melville, in one sense, you don't have to travel very far from the Tolstoy relationship with his wife to Melville, who also was a really complicated guy and had this wonderful wife. But wow, I mean, this guy seemed to be suffering from bipolar disorder. Not that it was diagnosed then, but that's what it would be today.
If a shrink took up Herman Melville, he'd say bipolar disorder, maybe a touch of schizophrenia, maybe he's got a little bit of alcoholism on top of it. He certainly drank too much, certainly in the last decades, which I think, you know, was a way of trying to control the manic depression. I think in the old days, manic depressives, probably in the new days, try to control these kinds of feelings by drinking too much.
Right, right. Now, you retraced some of Melville's steps. I don't remember talking with you about whether or not you did any of that in the Tolstoy book or whether you really had to because you had so much material to work with. Yeah. But, for example, Melville had this Berkshire estate, and I understand that you actually did a little bit of tracing. Can you go back there?
I spent a ton of time at the Melville house, which is just more or less as he left it. The fact that his study looks pretty much like it looked when he wrote Moby Dick in 1850.
In whose control and ownership?
I think probably some Melville Society or something like that owns it now.
So you can go in and take a tour and learn more?
Any tourist can walk by there and pay your $5 and go in and spend the day as Herman Melville in his house. And, the memorabilia and the pictures and some manuscripts. And certainly you can sit at the desk where he wrote Moby Dick and look out the window at Mount Greylock and see that great white whale of a mountain, which Melville said was his inspiration. So, yes, and I know I've traipsed around all the Melville sites. You know, I went to Manhattan, and I went down the Ganzevoort Street, named after his grandfather, and, you know, really paced up and down the docks where Melville worked as a customs officer. You know, I tracked him in London to the various places he walked and lived. I went to Liverpool. I actually even traced his journey in the Middle East. I went from Jerusalem out to the Dead Sea and up along the coast of the Jordan River and sort of spent time thinking about Melville's journey. You know, I've traveled many of the places where Melville traveled. I have gone. I was even, in fact, on one journey down in Peru and Chile. So, you know, not necessarily in connection there with Melville, but I was thinking of him. So with Melville, you really stuck with the fact that, you know, whereas Tolstoy left behind these voluminous diaries and thousands upon thousands of letters, Melville left virtually nothing behind, a handful of letters. His wife left behind just a very small handful of letters. So I had to kind of invent their relationship from whole cloth, just imagining what they were like from the little shards I had. I had to kind of pry open their lives.
Well, while we're on that subject, let me read just a little section of your book that I think really might be a little bit of Jay Perini talking here as well. Obviously, it's all Jay Perini talking, but you're drawing from history.
We won't tell people that.
We won't talk about that. But you say, "Now for the first time, Herman began to think about the nature of fiction and how it so often depended upon, even hugged, reality, embracing true stories. Herman realized with a shudder of quiet pleasure that what occurred here aboard the Acushnet might find itself one day in a work of fiction by his own hand. He knew it would, and vowed to listen keenly, to watch and record in his journal whatever transpired, collecting snippets of conversation, images, phrases, ideas for tales, moods, inklings, and omens." Do we know that, or can we just logically assume, based on these early travels of his, which I'd like you to tell us about as we move through this interview, that this was a guy who knew early on he was destined to write Moby Dick?
Well, we know from bits and pieces in his letters and journals that early on he had the ambitions to write. We know that from the time he was 17 or 18, he was trying his hand at poetry and fiction. So we can assume this is a guy who wanted to write. Then he goes off on these astonishing journeys around the world on these whaling ships, and he has marvelous adventures abroad. He goes down to the South Seas where he's kidnapped by a tribe of bisexual cannibals. I mean, he has adventures that...
You can't make that up.
Well, he's just, you know, has an astonishing life. But, you know, he writes about these cannibals and that whole experience in his first book, which was really a memoir. You know, he left behind. I mean, really, when you think about it, his first major four major books weren't novels really at all, but they were memoirs, Taipei, Omu, and so forth. You know, these White Jacket, these were not novels. These were memoirs, thinly disguised, hardly even disguised.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I had to go on, quite a lot, really, and on some level, although he's calling it fiction.
And I read in some cases where people would say, well, we learned that he exaggerated. How do you check the facts of those first four endeavors of his, and how do you know for sure? For example, there was one in particular, I think, where he was making all kinds of claims. It might have been his London trip to the House of Ill Repute, and he was making some exaggerations. And so how do you find that stuff out?
You know, you can't. The truth is, when something has taken place a couple hundred years ago, there's really no way of knowing what really happened, unless you had some astonishing documentation which turns up somewhere, which nothing has. So all we have is we have the probably exaggerated account of this House of Ill Repute in one of Melville's novels. Now, scholars have gone at it left, right, and center and said, well, there were places like this. We know he was in London then. So we're just having to make guesses. And so as a biographical novelist, you give it your best shot. You say, what might have happened? And you're shining your own imagination on the historical facts and trying to blow them up and see if you can create some reality. But you are, in the end of the day, writing a novel, and so you've given yourself a little bit of leeway there. I mean, I do say the passages of H.M., colon, a novel of Herman Melville. I don't say a biographical study of Herman Melville. And certainly there are biographical studies. I mean, Herschel Parker had devoted his lifetime to finding out every jot and tittle that exists about Herman Melville.
Mm-hmm.
He's written a two-volume work that totals, you know, 4,000 pages of scholarship and densely printed. It's almost unreadable, but nevertheless, for someone like me, it was a box of notes, priceless information.
And one of our own faculty members, Stephen Olson Smith, has devoted his career to studying the marginalia in Melville's own works, I understand. I've actually had Stephen on this program to talk about that. And you've had a chance to actually take a look at that, haven't you?
I've looked at that stuff. He's done a wonderful job. He's got a website called Melville's Marginalia,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, where they're putting stuff online that's really invaluable. And, in fact, one of the best records we have of Melville's intellectual life lies there in the marginalia, because he was a tremendous reader, and he kept notes in the margins, which are incredibly meticulous, interesting, reflective, and often deeply revealing about the nature of his ideas. And so, you know, I was kind of fascinated with to see what Melville was reading, and so I base a lot of my conjectures on Melville on what he was reading. We know he was very, very involved in reading the Odyssey of Homer, and so I kind of structured my novel as a kind of odyssey. I saw Melville as Odysseus wandering and finally returning home to the island of Ithaca and his wife Penelope in the harbor of New York City. And in fact, at the end of my novel, I quote that wonderful W.H. Auden poem about Herman Melville, where he talks about how he returned to the safe harbor of his marriage. So I was very interested in what Melville was reading. We know he was interested in the essays of Emerson, for example. He was reading Thoreau. But mainly, of course, he was obsessed with the work of his friend Nathaniel Hawthorne. And that relationship, of course, lies at the very center of my novel.
And you're listening to Jay Perini. He's the author of The Passages of H.M., a novel of Herman Melville. Tell us about that relationship with Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Well, you know, Hawthorne was, you know, 13 years older. He was the most famous author of the day in some ways. He had just recently, in 1850, had just come out with The Scarlet Letter, which was recognized as a classic from the get-go, one of America's greatest novels, possibly its greatest novel. And when Melville went to visit his aunt in the Berkshires in the summer of 1850, she said, you know, living here at the moment is Nathaniel Hawthorne and his wife, Sophia, and their two little children. And he was desperate to meet the great man, and a picnic was arranged. And lo and behold, the great man, who always dressed in black like Johnny Cash, and he was also the most handsome writer in America. If you see photographs of Hawthorne, I mean, he is, you know, unless he would have made a great Hollywood actor. You know, tall, dark, and handsome doesn't begin to describe Nathaniel Hawthorne. Also very laconic. And Melville was himself, you know, robust, a little bit overweight, kind of all over the map emotionally and personally. And so they were a study in contrasts. And Melville did everything he could to kind of woo Hawthorne, to get him on his side. And Hawthorne was intrigued. Invited Melville then to come over to the house called the Red Cottage in Lenox, Massachusetts. And they became fast friends, and it was Hawthorne who encouraged. He took a look at what Melville was working on, this story of whaling, based on Melville's own adventures 10 years earlier aboard the Acushnet and other whaling ships. And he said, look, you're just writing a straightforward whaling story here, but you're such a bright fellow, you could turn this into a huge philosophical quest novel. And in a sense, Hawthorne is responsible for turning Herman Melville into America's greatest novelist with Moby Dick. And so Hawthorne presided over the writing of Moby Dick. And so that relationship kind of ended with a grand moment when Herman Melville dedicated Moby Dick to the greatest author and mind of American literature, Nathaniel Hawthorne, my dear friend. That's the dedication, and he handed it to him over a celebratory dinner at a hotel, the Lenox House Hotel in Lenox, still there. And Curtis Hotel is called now. It's the same place. And, of course, they got too close. I think Melville had a strong attraction to men in a certain manly sort of way more than anything. And this freaked out Hawthorne, who was really a very private, introverted man. Melville, wildly extroverted. Hawthorne, deeply, deeply, deeply shy. And I think he was freaked out by Herman Melville. And before long, he fled. He said, enough already of Herman Melville and his antics. I'm getting out of here. And he packed up his family very, very unexpectedly, put everything in a carriage, and they drove off to near Boston, outside of Boston. And really, that ended the relationship for the most part. I mean, they met up here and there a little bit. But for the most part, that ended the relationship and the friendship. And I think Melville was sunk into a very deep depression. Then the rejection, then out comes the novel, Moby Dick, and reviewers scratched their heads, readers scratched their heads, didn't know what to make of this great rambling, philosophical, speculative novel, didn't read like a whaling story at all. And Melville sold no copies and made no money, and once again went into debt and almost went bankrupt, had to sell the estate in the Berkshires, moved back to New York City, where for the last 20-some years of his life he lived in extreme obscurity, virtually unknown as a writer, mostly just pecking away at a book-length poem about his travels in the Middle East. It's called Clarel, and it's the worst poem ever written. I mean, it's you know, 18,000 lines of drivel, almost beyond unreadable. I mean, I've read it three times, and it was a work of active duty. And every time saying to myself, there has to be more here than meets the eye, and I suspect there's not. So Melville goes into a three-decade depression, and pretty much falls apart until the very end of his life, last year of his life. He goes on one final sea journey. He sees there's a new steamboat that's making journeys to the Bermuda Islands. And so his wife said, go ahead, but I'm not coming, but you can go. And on this journey, he took out his notebook and he suddenly wrote in one fell swoop, Billy Budd, which is, you know, his second great masterpiece.
Sure.
And possibly one of the greatest works of fiction, unquestionably, one of the greatest works of American fiction. Nobody would deny that Billy Budd is a major work of art. Mm-hmm. So he writes this on the ship, comes back with it, and dies, and it's left in his notebooks, unpublished. Isn't really published till quite a long time after his death. And then Melville's reputation was in abeyance, and no one knew who he was. You know, his obituary in the New York Times was one line, which said, Henry Melville, dead. They didn't even get his name right.
Who figured this out? How did he, after his death, come out of obscurity?
What happened was a number of scholar critics began digging around in old American books, and there was one Englishman in particular who wrote for in some American journals and said, here's a great writer that's undiscovered. He was once popular briefly during his lifetime, but then seems to have disappeared. And take a look at Moby Dick. It's astonishing. And then certain English writers picked up on this. For example, D.H. Lawrence picked up on it and said, wow, this is a truly great novel. And writers picked up, especially writers, I think, you know, finally Herman Melville came of age when modernism came about in the sort of 1915 to 1925, 30. Suddenly there was an appetite for books that were complex, that were, you know, had wavering viewpoints and didn't pursue a simple, linear, straightforward way of narration. And so suddenly the audience was ripe for Moby Dick. You know, I always say that Melville was born posthumously. You know, he would have been better off being born and coming of age as a writer in about 1920. He would have been immediately taken up as the James Joyce or the D.H. Lawrence of his time, Hemingway or Fitzgerald. But, you know, he didn't. That's when his reputation rose. And in truth, it wasn't until the 1950s that Melville was an established classic who was regularly taught in American colleges and regarded around the world as the great 19th century writer, someone equal to, if not greater than, Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Is it possible today that there are people like Melville writing novels? Hey, I might be talking to one.
Maybe it's me. Maybe I'm the new Herman Melville.
Right, yeah. You know, in the 21st century, they're going to be looking back on who is it? I mean, I wonder if it's possible today because of the way the market works and the way books get so quickly to print. It's hard to believe that in this mass production society and now online that people could miss something the way they missed Melville.
Well, the problem is there's so much stuff now.
Well, that's true, yeah.
I think it becomes almost impossible to sort out what's good from what's bad.
Good point.
And we don't actually have book reviewing culture anymore that's in even the least reliable or interesting. Whereas, you know, for instance, I just read a biography of Sinclair Lewis. And when Babbitt came out in sort of 1920s, he got over 300 reviews in newspapers. And they were extremely intelligent, often lengthy and sophisticated reviews. And so it was possible to look at Babbitt and say, here are its pros and cons. But certainly everybody was talking about it and reading it, and it was properly evaluated. Nowadays, if you got not 300, but if you got 30 reviews, it would be a miracle.
Right.
I mean, you know, this book on Herman Melville probably got 10 major reviews, maybe 20 reviews, major reviews. And that would be considered a vast success. I mean, you know, Doubleday said, wow, you got so much attention for your novel. And someone, you know, who hasn't had my track record might be lucky to get two or three reviews.
Yeah.
And so, in other words, there are no book reviews. This is tragic. I used to, when I was a young novelist 20, 30 years ago, I could expect maybe a review in Time or Newsweek. You know, one of my earlier books reviewed in Time magazine. Now Time magazine might review a book every month or two. One book every month or two. So, in other words, there's just, and now there are also no bookstores. So where do you go to see books to find out what's being published? So really, in a sense, the literary culture is hanging on by a thread. It's wedged into a little tiny corner. And there are zillions of writers now, but it's all self-publication, and there's no readers. And because there are no serious reviewers left, more or less, I mean, I could probably name 10 in the country, and I know who they are. I mean, that's a tragic situation when I could have named 300 from 1920.
Right. I want to go back to your discussion of Hawthorne. In reading your book, there were a number of times where Melville, in his young life especially, on these sea journeys, got very close to a man. And the nature of Melville's reaction and sexual and emotional appeal or interest in other men really struck me as the fact that this is a guy who had to be at least bisexual, if not gay. I just wonder what we know about that and how much in your novel you just picked up from rough notes.
Well, I mean, if you read his novels carefully, there's no question that whenever a young man comes into the novel, he gets very interested.
Yeah.
There's tremendous interest in that. And then there's now, in the last 30 years, there's a whole library of books about the homoerotic elements in Herman Melville's writing. You know, for instance, James Creech, for example, is a great Melville scholar, and he's written a book called Closet Writing, Gay Reading, The Case of Melville's Pierre. But Pierre is, you know, obviously almost a coming-out novel. You look at the work of, you know, Jaina Arger Singer or Leland Pearson. There's just so many people, going back to Newton Arvin, who in 1950 wrote a book about Melville, which really clearly stressed his homoerotic side. That's, you know, 1950, Newton Arvin. So for 60 years now, scholars have pointed to the obvious. You know, Billy Budd, you can't read that except as a kind of homoerotic novel. So you look at the work, and you say, well, it's a theme he returns to again and again and again in his work. So he's obviously interested in it. He is married and has four children, so you can't say that he's gay. You can only say that he's, you know, he's got a lot of conflicting sexual feelings, which is not unusual in the world. So that's probably what we're really looking at here, but he certainly was interested in tracing and depicting scenes of homoeroticism in his own writing from start to finish.
One other thing about his sea journeys that I wanted to touch on, he ran into some real difficult sea captains. That's a kind way of putting it. Raging maniacs, yeah, would be more like it. And isn't it interesting, you know, along comes Captain Ahab. So I have to ask you, he certainly must have taken from his own personal experiences in those younger years something into Moby Dick.
He had a terrible camp on the Acushnet, which is main journey. He was on that, signed up for years on that whaling boat, and they went all the way down the coast of Latin America, around the Cape Horn, up through Chile and Peru, over to the crossing the line of the equator, but the guy's name was Valentine Pease, and he was a tyrant of the first water. So that was, you know, why when they got to the Marquesas, the islands, that Toby Green and Melville, who were best friends, said enough already and jumped ship. And that's how they got captured by these cannibals. Yeah, he ran into one crazy captain after another. Not unusual in those days. I mean, if you want to be captain of a whaling ship in the early 19th century, you probably had to have a screw loose, so or be a kind of a tyrant of some kind.
Right, right. Well, we've run out of time, Jay, but I really do appreciate your joining us today. We look forward to seeing the book in the bookstores, of course, and eventually in the movies. This is great that Sam Silva is going to be working with you. She's very talented, and I know that's going to work out very well. And we wish you the very best of luck.
Oh, thank you, Bob. The paperback comes out in, I think it's November.
Great. And it's The Passages of H.M., A Novel of Herman Melville. Thanks so much for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob.
The engineer for today's show is Dustin Verberg. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.